accession number 20590, reel 6.
Norman Mitchell, reel 6. So we've been through the Ardennes.
Yeah, and then we've done the Rifford, and then we were coming back up from Brussels and stopped at a going back into the up to do some more scrapping, and we stopped at a place just outside of Venlo in Holland, and there was a lovely hut there, and we thought, wonderful, we'll try. Oh, and it was open. Oh, down for the night. To be woken the following morning at about 7 o'clock, a lot of noise outside. I thought, what the devil's all this sort of thing? And then somebody very surreptitiously opened the door and come in. It was a Roman Catholic priest. Sure, I'm awfully sorry, but this is our temporary church. So we slept in a Roman Catholic church. Well, a substitute cabinet church had been bombed apparently, and we were in the vestry, I presume, in there, and then the main church was the other side of the. A big screen, yeah. So we were in good company that night. Hey.
So you were quite independent where you could find your own accommodation.
Oh, yeah, we with a reconnaissance troop, if you like that, you are absolutely independent. You have you draw your own rations, which was the old, God bless it, 14-man pack. And there were 15 of you, so every 14 days you'd get two. And that was food for the 14-man pack was food for the day, you say, yeah.
So you that would consists find your own accommodation.
Well, wherever we have, or else if no accommodation, we had bivouacs, which we used to fix to the side of the armoured car, and you know, hope that it wasn't blowing too hard, because it would blow under the armoured car straight into the most uncomfortable. That's what.
So you were really very self-sufficient.
Very self-sufficient.
More,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Most. So anyway, when you come back into what they call a squadron area, you would then go for food we prepared by the squadron cooks. But normally, you used to arrange all this yourself, yeah.
And what sort of radios were you using?
19. The 19 set we used in those days, yeah.
What do you think about those?
It was sufficient. The only time you were in trouble is if you were in an area with a lot of trees about, forest about, yeah. Yeah. In Holland... God, you could hear from miles. no obstruction. This, yeah, absolutely fabulous that was. Yeah, you could hear. Yeah. But get in the Reichswald and you were, the distance was. But then, of course, we didn't go in until afterwards. But you were still, wireless communication was very, very difficult.
So, after.
Crossing the Rhine?
Yeah.
Slept in the gliders at Hameln-Kelm. Mm-hmm. And then we obviously fought our way right across Germany. All sorts of things, I think.
Remember some particular
engagement? Bocholt. Bocholt, we remember.
What happened there?
Well, the artillery had been pounding it, sort of thing, and then we went in to clear out the... They were on the way out, sort of thing, and we came across a bank. A German bank. And all the money had come out, hadn't it? Million mark notes. Worth what? Nothing.
Worth it.
Worthless. All scattered everywhere while they'd blown it up. I think it'd been bombed. I think a bomb had gone down through the middle and thrown it everywhere. Yeah. Then the artillery were having a bash at it as well because it was defended. Yeah, money all over the place, yeah. And not worth a penny.
No one picking it up?
No. Same as all the money we used to take out the prisoners of war. Mm. No good to us at all. Well, we couldn't exchange it.
Yeah.
The French francs and Belgian francs and that. They all had to be handed in to the divisional bank.
Right.
Oh. We burnt them all.
Did we?
Yeah. We couldn't do anything with them.
No.
That's the only thing we had time to take off them, you see.
Yeah.
The odd Luger pistol, which we promptly sold to the Americans.
Oh, really? What did you get for a Luger pistol?
Oh, quite a few bob you get with them. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they're quite valuable.
Sort of money.
It's difficult to tell now because it was all in dollars then, and the dollars were, I think, were they $3 for the pound or something? Something like that in that time, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you get $20 or $30 for a Luger any old time, yeah, yeah.
Did you get
The Americans really like
them. Oh, by heaven, they're prized them, yeah. What's the Luger? Mm. They could take them home and keep them as their own personal.
Anything else they like buying?
No, that was the only thing we had of any value to them, you see, I suppose. Yeah.
So where else can you remember on your journey through Germany?
Well, we eventually got across Germany to... I'm just trying to think where this was now. In April of 45, we were moving up towards... It must have been towards Bremen, I presume. Yeah, there's the River Aller we crossed, but the problem was we couldn't get the half track with the assault troop, and we couldn't get it because they were 10 tons and it was only a class 9 bridge, so the armored cars could go over it, but not us. So we actually went over with old Harry Goldsmith, and we got so far and got held up, and he decided he wasn't going to go back any farther. So we put the whole squadron in around this farmyard. One of the biggest mistakes he ever made, as we got attacked during the night by about 4 companies of Marines that were in the air close by. We were trying to get in to take this farmhouse off us, and there was no way. Poor old Harry got very badly wounded, and he had to go back the following morning. But we were about the only place in the line that didn't give way. We were still there in the morning, and then the infantry came down and relieved us, and we got back. And we suffered, 1 killed and 14 wounded, which was remarkable considering what we were in. I mean, the farmhouse went up in smoke.
So what was being fired at you?
Everything. Bazookas, hand grenades, the old Schmeissner, which is the German equivalent of the Tommy gun. Yeah. How we didn't travel for several more cars, I should never know. Friday the 13th of April.
And you were actually in the
wonderful farmhouse. Wonderful description of that in here, yeah.
You were in the farmhouse.
I was actually in the farmhouse, yeah.
What were you firing?
Well, I was firing a Bren gun, and then we decided that Harry Goldsmith decided to ask Frank. Well, Frank, he said, Frank, can you go back to the village behind? There's a battalion, the company of the East Lancs infantry up there. Can you go back and ask them to come down and give us a hand to come out, get out? Because there was a gap behind us, and then we'll come back and we'll make up their area. So, Frank Lyle said, "Hey, Mitch, have you been Mitchell? That was me. Hey, Mitch, fancy your job?" I said, "What's it? We go back where was it? Wheelwright." Oh, I said, "I suppose so. We can do that." So we trips off me with me Sten gun and him, but he picks up there, up the hedges, and it was a good mile and a half back to the village. Got into their position without being stopped, and found out where their company headquarters was. He went in and saw them, and the company, he said, "No," he said, "you've got yourself in the mess. You get bloody well get yourselves out of it." So, and, you know, he said, "Well, is there nothing? Because we're in desperate straits. We're getting short of ammo. Well, that's your fault. You shouldn't be down there." I'm sure Frank and I had to go back down the road, didn't we, and say sorry.
What was thought about that?
Nothing. His view was that he was already heavily engaged, and he was. Things weren't easy, and the situation was very fluid. You know, there was so much going on all around. What the Germans were trying to do was find out where we were putting the bridge across to destroy it. Well, they never did. But it was a very exciting night. And the following day, they put the infantry out in front of us. We came back, and then, with the number of vehicles that had been knocked out, we then joined A squadron to make what they call a composite squadron, until we could get back strength, which we did about 2 or 3 weeks after. Old David Dorr was very badly wounded in his eye and his ankle. And then...
Where was that?
At this farmhouse. Yeah. We saw him out the following morning on an ambulance, and he said, "Cheerio, chaps, I'll see you again." But he didn't. And he eventually, after the war, I see him. So he did recover all right, yeah. I was a bit funny, but
yeah.
Apart from that, he's okay.
So after that, you carried on.
Well, after that, we carried on, and I mean, Bremen was attacked, but we weren't involved in. We were supposed to come in at the end on the attack on Bremen, but we weren't needed because the Burgomaster surrendered it, and then we went on up then to crossing the Elbe, prior to assaulting Hamburg. But that never came off because the armistice was signed. We were patrolling into the outskirts there, but I suppose 2 or 3 days before, but not doing a great deal because we knew what was... It was, yeah, we knew something was happening, you know, and so eventually it was surrendered and we took over the city.
What did you actually do personally in the taking
over? Well, during that time, we on VE Day, we did celebrate. We had a few bottles and we did celebrate. We took over a ground floor flat of a German family and pushed them upstairs. And so we had somewhere to sleep for that. And the most remarkable thing, if you go back to what I said at the beginning of going on a war office selection board, when we got into Hamburg and we were having our party, the colonel should come around, Colonel Williams. And in the various conversations, he said, are you sorry that you didn't become an officer? I beg your pardon. He remembered. I said, well, no, I'm not sorry. I said, one good thing is, having done what I've done, I'm here. If I'd have gone elsewhere, I may not have been here. So I said, well, I'm quite happy. Oh, fair enough. That was it.
Did you all have a feeling that locked that you were still alive?
Oh, yeah. There was, there's no skill in ducking. The same old thing, you know, as we used to say, if there's one with your name on it, you'll get it, whether you're here, there, or anywhere else. So, mind you, still don't do anything too stupid or blatant. You don't stick your neck out, but on the other hand, I mean, you take that view that, well, if you're going to go, you're going to go.
Did anyone crack under?
Oh, yes. We got rid of one or two, yeah. Because they were... I think we were more sorry for them than anything.
When you say got rid of?
Oh, well, move them back, yeah. We would get somebody else up, yeah, because there was a danger.
How would they, you know, they were sort of going?
Oh, well, we used to... Well, they used to call it battle exhaustion. We didn't call it that. We used to call it bomb happy. That was our expression, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, you could see anybody
what
going.
How would you recognise it?
Various ways it reacts, you know. Panic when things are getting a bit hot, you know, and the guy's shaking and all of that. What do I do next? What's happening? Well, anyway, you can't put up with that. I mean, he's a danger to everybody else and himself. Well, the exhaustion cases in the... In the division, they're quite heavy. Battle exhaustion cases, yeah.
So
towards the end, you see, because when all the experienced people were gradually, you know, getting less and less, and you're getting all the young, inexperienced ones in, and they come in straight from training, straight into, it takes a bit of doing. We were lucky. When we went into Normandy, at least we had a spell of static work. And could learn the rule of the battlefield, when to duck and when not, and that was it. But these youngsters coming out have been to infantry school, and frankly, you felt a lot of them, you know, felt sorry for, because they're only just come out of school, some of them, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, you know.
So what happened to them? They were sent back down,
And they were found jobs back. There were. What they call reinforcement holding units on the way up. Anybody coming back from leave would come to that, proudly joining and they would be put in there doing the cooking, the cleaning, and things of that. And the officers, just the same. Mm. Well, we had a couple of them we had to send back.
Really?
Oh, dear.
That must be awkward if they're in command of you. And...
Oh, no, the next thing man takes over.
Right.
The Lieutenant Bell, I remember, correctly refused an order from old Harry Goldsmith. He had him back in no time. took over the job himself. Yeah. Wanted him to attack a certain wood. Mm. And he said, no, he's not doing that. No, that. He said, right, get back there. And he led the... Thoroughly enjoyed it, too.
Mm.
He was a character. He was...
Goldsmith,
Harry Goldsmith, yeah. He was a director or part owner of the Gold Bullion Company, Toccato and Goldsmith.
Mm.
He's dead now. He died some years ago, but...
He was a
wild fellow, yeah.
Was he?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Germans, hated him. He hated him, yeah. God, dear. Don't think I've ever seen such hate from one person to somebody else, yeah. you take him prisoner, and take him prisoner, take him back to the squad, because he could interrogate him. And if it was raining, he wouldn't let you take him straight under the cage. He said, no, let him get wet. And he'd keep him there, stood in the rain for hours on end, 2 or 3 hours on end. All right, get rid of him. Yeah. Yeah. I really was, yeah. But as a leader, oh, no bother, yeah. His classic was with his driver. He had a driver called Trooper Doughty, and he used to come up front with us, you know, because of all the muck flying around, and all his drivers duck all over the place. And Harry had an unfortunate impediment in his speech, and they were up there. There's old Doughty diving at everything, but old Davy Dog would stay there, and he used to turn around to his driver. I won't stammer like he did. Don't be silly, Doughty, he said. They're not firing at you. But with the stammer, it went on. It was delightful guy. Yeah. Yeah. And I met him years after, whilst I was working with Unilever. I met him in the Connaught Rooms in London. You know, the Connaught Rooms, where big place, where Unilever had a big launch of a new product. And I went down to the gents and was just washing my hands, and the guy was coming up to brush me down like they do. And there was this other big fellow. He was having a brush down, and he looked at me, and we both, he said, I know you, don't I? I said, yeah, and I know you, don't I? And we got chatting. Absolutely remarkable, yeah. He was eventually Conservative Member of Parliament for South Coventry, I think, for a while. Yeah, yeah.
So, back to Germany.
Back to Germany. Well, we then, I mean, for the next...
So you were in Hamburg,
yeah. The divisional headquarters was at the Atlantic Hotel, and we used to mount guard there. Mm-hmm. Ceremonial guard, yellow, blanco, and polished brasses, yeah, I tell you, yeah.
So how did you feel to be doing something like that? You know,
guarding something
that didn't really guarding.
Oh, a bit mundane. And we were there for about 6 months, and then we moved down to the Ruhr to Solingen Oelig, which is Solingen is the German Sheffield, and we were there for the Crown Prince factory. We then moved from there a few miles down to the road to a place called Hilden. The 53rd Div headquarters was there, the barracks, and we were at the squadron. We were put down there as Div HQ protection. I mean, and that was it. I then transferred from being an armoured car driver to the squadron clerk. No guards, no duties, just look after the old, and that was when. I then took over. At Hilden, I took over as the squadron clerk.
Right, and what were the duties involved?
Oh, the administration of the squadron. Under the command of the squadron commander, old Dizzy Cragen, and he was called Dizzy because his initials were DSC. And he was the one that was chairman of Prudential. Mm-hmm. He's the one that not last year, because we didn't have a meeting, the year before. He still comes up, he's in his 80s, but very pleasant guy, yeah.
So what were you actually doing?
Typing squadron orders out, keeping the records of what was going on, making out charge sheets for the sergeant major, and all sorts of things like that, yeah.
So you had a pretty good idea of what was going on then?
Oh, I knew what to do, yeah. The chappie that had done it up till then, what had happened then, a chappie called George Fenn, with the squadron cart, went in England right the way through, and when we got there, he was about to be demobbed. And he came and saw me. He said, "Mitch," he said, "there's a job going if you want it." I knew him. I knew him quite well, George. And I said, "What is he just going to?" I said, "What really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Now look, it's a doddle." He said, "No guards, no duties, and nobody can mess you about." But I said, "I'm only a trooper." I said, "He said, don't worry." He said, "That'll change very quickly." Well, I was made up to a corporal in a very short space of time to give me a bit of authority. You see.
So you had quite a good insight into what was going on.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So what were people being put on charges for?
Oh, various things, you know, absent without leave, coming in late at night when, you know, after time. And the odd thing of not having a haircut, you know. We had a lieutenant who was rather fussy about haircuts until one day he came in and the sergeant major was sat the other side. And he said, "I want this man put on a charge." And the old Buck said, "And what for?" He said, "His haircut." He said, "Well, have you looked in the mirror lately yourself?" Oh dear, whoops. Yeah. odd things, you know, like that sort of thing. That nothing startling.
So what was, I mean, the atmosphere must have suddenly become quite different to when you were in the
film. Oh, completely, yeah. And I enjoyed every minute of it. It was all quiet down then, yeah. No cleaning the car, no topping up the engine with oil and getting my hands dirty, which I hated. And that was it. And I was in the office. I was fireproof.
So
then we were disbanded then. We were disbanded in 1946 on the 14th of June. I joined. I did spend a little time with a regiment called the North Irish Horse at Wuppertal, but it was so short, it's not worth worrying about.
So you went from being that a squadron clerk,
yeah,
to this other place, North Irish Horse,
yeah, and I stayed at Wuppertal in Germany, but with they were due to be disbanded anyway. Why they sent us there, I just don't know, but they were disbanded shortly after, and on the 14th of June, I joined the 10th Hussars. Prince of Wales' own,
right.
In Lübeck, northwest Germany.
Right. Okay. So what was it like in Lübeck?
And that was okay. Well, quite nice. A bit damaged, but quite pleasant. We were in the barracks there at Lübeck. I was squadron clerk there as well. I managed to get my feet under the table again, which was rather handy. And I was there until I was demobbed. But every so often, they used to detach one squadron. Used to go to a place, a town called Ratzeburg, which was a bit up near the British and Russian zone boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Right. Have a pause.
Yeah.
So at Lübeck.
Yeah. So we were a squadron was detached every so often for about 6 weeks to Ratzeburg, and then from there one used to would patrol the frontier between the British and Russian zones, and all the crossing places were blocked. You see, with a, and you used to have to visit these in the morning, lunchtime, and again in the evening, just to see that everything was okay, and also to pick up people, displaced people that were crossing the line from the Russian to the British zone, bring them back. They were then questioned and were sent farther on down.
Right. So this was a real frontier?
Between the British and Russian zones of Germany, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what did you feel about? I mean, the Russians had been our allies, and now, you know, we were manning a frontier. And
well, it's really strange. You could... I then, for a while up there, the squadron office stayed in Lübeck, but in view of my experience with vehicles, I used to go to Ratzeburg, and I would go on the patrols up there. Now, sometimes you could, there's some Russians you could speak to that were manning the other side, and there were some you couldn't. But one got to know one particular Russian sergeant, I don't know what his name was, but we always, every time I was on duty, he used to come by and used to come up to our, because there was the blockies my side and the blockies theirs, and he'd come, you wave and he'd come over, and the strange thing of him Russian and me English, he couldn't speak English, I couldn't speak Russian, so he used to converse in German.
And what did you talk about? About
what we were doing, where we came from, what was happening, and what we did, and he said to me, look, you know, when you pick up, if any of my men come over your side, don't bring them back to me. He said, just give them a good kick up the backside and send them so they come back on their own. And he said, if I have to take them from you, they get charged and they get shot. I said, what? Oh, yeah. He said, just a... And then they turn around the corner, bang, and that's it. He said, so, you know... Well, they used to come over stealing cattle and obviously affairs with ladies, as you may well gather. That was very, very blatant.
So did some of the Russian soldiers come over and stay over?
No. They'd come over and raid, and then they'd go back. You see, well, as long as they went back, I mean, there wasn't a heck of a lot we can do. Because, I mean, they manned these crossing posts. Everyone was manned 24 hours a day. We used to visit them 3 times. And there was about perhaps, 6 or 7 of these posts, and used to run down over, I suppose, about 20-odd miles. I used to visit one and come down. And then there was one pleasant bit about that, and that was that there was a Salvation Army canteen. This strange to you? There was a Salvation Army canteen there at a place called Mern. How it got there, I don't know.
It was manned by British.
Manned by British Salvationists, yeah. Absolutely remarkable, yeah.
So what did you get in there?
Well, you know, you're going for morning coffee and perhaps the odd cake that they'd made, that they'd managed to get some things to do with, yeah. It was quite surprising. Yeah. I don't know about that. Yeah.
It was for all the British troops.
Oh, yeah.
What about the displaced persons? I mean, lots of them all
Well, the camps there, you see, were, you know, thousands in there. And
were
whilst
the camps near you? I mean,
in around the Lubeck area, yeah, a lot of them there. And they were a majority Polish. And for a while, we were shipping them back to, well, what was Szczecin, under the reapportionment of land after the war. But it's what was called Szczecin. And there was a converted oil tanker, German oil tanker, that had been converted for troop carrying, the SS Isar. And that used to ferry back about 1,500, 2,000 of these to Szczecin, but you had to have an armed party aboard to make sure that it got there.
Because where would they want to go?
Sweden. We got to Stockholm. We did once, yeah. Prior to the armed party being aboard, yeah.
They escaped from the transport?
Oh, well, no, they take over the ship and give the captain his instructions, and that was it. He wasn't going to argue. They're all German. All the crew, remarkable the crew, they all speak fluent English. I mean, they'd all been merchant seamen even before the war, and they knew Cardiff and Newport. They knew very, very well. They're quite good fun, actually, the crew on them. Yeah. So then you'd get to Szczecin. You'd have to get there in the evening. You'd then have to anchor off the end of the river, whose name I don't know. Always rather frightening, because just a few... A few hundred yards away was a sunken Red Cross ship, yeah, at the mouth of the river. Then the pilot would come out, because he couldn't pilot you up there at night. He'd come out during the day and he'd go up to the quay, and then they'd be offloaded.
And did you know what their future might be?
Straight to another displaced persons camp. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, how sort of bedraggled were they?
They weren't bedraggled. I mean. I mean, no doubt, when they were first liberated, that would have been a very bad way. But then they'd been there. This was going into 1946, 47. Well, of course, food was going out, clothes were going out by the UNRWA, you know, and the camps were run by United Nations personnel. But the remarkable thing was, everybody was all in the camp the night before, ready to go the following morning, it'd be amazing, only half of them would turn up. And the rest of the camp would be deserted because they didn't want to go back. And then as soon as the ship had gone, they're back in the camp again. Absolutely remarkable.
So they were quite a resourceful lot then.
Oh, they were very resourceful, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did you get on with them?
Oh, we got on with them, yeah. Okay. The only crib they ever had with us was that... they were under the impression that under the Potsdam Agreement, any things we took over like that sort of thing, when we liberated them, they'd get paid. No way.
Yeah. I mean, there were tales about the DPs, you know, sort of stealing things.
Oh, yeah, well, we did. We were on, you got on patrol to stop them. And what could you do? We'd liberated them. We'd beat the Germans. We arrested them for robbing the Germans. Now, it was a very, very odd situation. Yeah, yeah.
That's the end of Reel 6, Norman Mitchell.
Jolly good.